that's to learn a little bit about all of you. So I'm going to pop open a poll on the screen. There are going to be two introductory questions, and I will ask the audience to go ahead and scroll through that pop-up window and start casting your individual responses to these questions. As they're doing that, Laura, you can feel free to get your presentation materials up on the screen. And I'll just narrate some of the results I'm starting to see, and then I'll share that with the audience. About a quarter of you have voted. We'd like to get at least two-thirds to three-quarters of you in there. We're looking to see what type of an organization you might represent, and then your level of experience on working with renewable energy on landfills. So as I'm waiting for a few more responses to come in, Laura, your slides are up and they look great, which I'm glad to see. And I'm gonna go ahead and just give it just a second or two more because we hit 75%, that's excellent. So let me go ahead and end this poll and let's take a look at those results. So Laura, as I'm scrolling through here, it looks like about a quarter of the audience represents state government agencies, and then about another quarter are coming from consulting or law firms. We do also have representation from the federal government, local governments. We have some renewable land developers or financiers on, and then a couple of nonprofits or NGOs with some other participants from other organizational types. And then surprisingly here, about a third of the audience has no experience working with renewable energy on their landfills or brownfields or sites. And then about another third has a little, like they've done one project. About a quarter have done some, 2 to 5. And then about 10% of them have done a lot. So we've got a nice distribution in our audience today. So I'm going to go ahead and close that out. If the box doesn't close, click the X in the upper corner. You can close those poll results. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Laura Strein from EPA's Repowering America's Land Initiative to take it over. Laura?
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, Jean. That was a great introduction and instructions on how to use all of the features. Thank you. My name is Laura Strein. I will be presenting and also moderating today's panel. I'm the team leader for Repowering America's Land Initiative. I've worked for EPA for over 20 years, and for two of those years with Repowering America's Land Initiative. I'm really excited to be here today with my colleagues from Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York. They are three leading states with really robust programs that encourage renewable energy on contaminated lands. So please join me in welcoming our panel. We have Emily Chesson, who is a senior development associate with the Build Ready program at the New York State Energy Redevelopment Research and Development Authority, NYSERDA. Prior to NYSERDA, Emily worked in clean energy consulting, helping governments develop and implement renewable energy and climate change policies at all levels of government. We are also joined by Gina Bellotto. She's the Solar Programs Manager for the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources. In this position, she is responsible for day-to-day operations of the Solar Massachusetts Renewable Target, or SMART program, which is the state's main solar incentive. And before her role at the state, she worked in the renewable energy industry, and there she analyzed prospective solar projects, contracted with community solar off-takers, and she worked in site acquisition, business development, and sales operations. We also have Steve Myers here with us today. Steve has been with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection since 1991. In his current role, he is supervisor of the clean energy section with New Jersey, and he also collaborates with the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities. He has spent the first part of his career in site remediation and waste management. He also is joined the Bureau of Climate Change and Clean Energy, which is currently a part of the Air Quality, Energy, and Sustainability Program, focusing on leveraging geographic information systems to support environmentally responsible renewable energy siting. That was quite a mouthful. He has so much experience, and he's supported Repowering since its inception on various mapping tools, policy databases, and other program development matters. New Jersey was one of the first Repowering pilot states. So the presentation today will touch on the following topics you can see on the slide. We plan to spend a significant amount of time hearing from our state panelists today. I want to clarify one word that's already showing up here. It's repowering. We use this word to mean siting renewable energy resources on land with perceived or actual contamination. So you'll hear me use this term repowering throughout the presentation. First today, I will begin by presenting EPA's analysis of state programs. Then our state panelists will present on their programs, and then we'll have a panel discussion. That will be followed by audience questions. So we really are looking forward to getting your questions and having you be a really integral part of this conversation. Any questions that are not answered live today, we will answer in follow-up on email. So this graphic shows why communities select renewable energy for contaminated land reuse. And whether your state's goal is to provide low-cost energy or to protect open space, renewable energy is a great way to reuse sites. Repowering America's Land Initiative is one of many programs in the Office of Land and Emergency Management. Part of that office's mission is to encourage redevelopment of Superfund sites, brownfields, landfills, mine lands, RCRA sites, and state cleanup program sites. So oftentimes there are limited site reuse options for these type of contaminated lands, and renewable energy can be one great way to reuse certain sites. OLEM, the Office of Land and Emergency Management, has other programs that focus on broader topics of site redevelopment. Repowering America's Land Initiative is specifically focused on renewable energy and redevelopment at sites. So for example, we have the Superfund Redevelopment Program. It's specifically focused on renewable energy development at Superfund sites. And EPA's Brownfields Program has opportunities for grants to communities considering cleanup and reuse. And repowering can be your resource or point of contact for renewable energy on any of these programs. In addition to sharing our analysis of successful state programs, that's what we're here to talk about today. We have great resources on our website. We track hundreds of projects and communities of all across the country. We track benefits for those projects, including revenue to local governments, jobs, and environmental protection. And we have many interactive tools, such as our National Mapper tool that screens sites for renewable energy. We also have a contact in every regional office at EPA. You can find that list also on our website. Please visit our website and also sign up for our listserv to learn more. We have provided technical assistance to states. One recent example of this is our interactions with the Minnesota Brightfields Initiative, where we helped analyze landfill and renewable energy data for Minnesota. And they've been working very hard on their repowering programs. And we're looking forward to hearing more about opportunities for landfill and solar in Minnesota. So this administration has a big focus on climate change. We'd like to just first start out by saying that everything you will hear about today is work that originated at the state and local level. We really recognize that states are the leaders on climate change, and that public and private development on these types of sites really rely on the state policies that make it possible to build projects that result in carbon emissions. Our program tallies more than 1.5 million metric tons of carbon equivalent from the projects that are considered repowering projects across the country. Another goal of this administration is to promote environmental justice, and repowering information shows that Projects may offer environmental justice benefits such as low-cost energy programs for consumers or local job training programs. The photo here on this slide shows solar installers being trained on a project in Colorado. The Repowering Initiative is here to share information and assist with state and local solutions to climate change. So the goal of today's webinar is to help you understand state program options for renewable energy on contaminated lands and for you to see EPA as a resource to help you engage on this topic. We have studied 4 states to help you better understand the details of state policies and what makes them successful. So no matter where you are in selecting and designing new programs or modifying existing programs, our information can help you. You might be thinking, is this webinar just for state experts today? Or what if my state already has renewable energy programs or no programs at all? Or what if we have a niche market that we're going after? We certainly hope to appeal to many state environmental and energy leaders today. And also in this webinar, we intend to provide information for renewable energy developers, community members, and other stakeholders to help their engagement on these programs. So this material is designed to be useful to a variety of audiences and a variety of states. It really can include states with robust repowering programs already or states that don't have programs. And we'll be describing a range of features and also hope to connect you with more ideas in the future on this information. Our historical data shows that for repowering projects for solar, most projects come in at about 5 megawatts per project. However, some states are looking for larger sites for development, such as New York. In addition, some states are interested in finding ways to repurpose closed mine sites, and we are here to help you connect with those types of opportunities and information from states that have already started looking at these types of options. So no matter what your starting point, our information can help you. And when you hear from our panelists today, you'll hear that there are many common themes among the state programs, but each state really takes a different approach to these repowering policies. So we look forward to the additional conversations, and please reach out to me or another team member for assistance. So the key concept for today is that repowering programs involve both renewable energy programs and contaminated site reuse programs. So an example of a standalone renewable energy program might be a renewable energy credit program. And an example of a standalone contaminated site reuse program is, for example, a brownfield grant program. So we're really looking at the cross-section. And for example, Massachusetts has a renewable energy credit program that specifically adds a higher dollar value per kilowatt hour for solar on landfills. So that would be an example of this cross-section of programs. And then the New Jersey has a site remediation fund that provides loans and grants for assessment, remediation, and redevelopment planning for contaminated sites. So that gives an option for grants covering a significant amount of cost of remedial actions for projects involving redevelopment of a property for renewable energy. So those are 2 examples of the types of programs we're talking about today. And again, clarifying some terms, repowering means siting renewable energy resources on land with perceived or actual contamination for today. And we may use the terms policies and programs interchangeably. One thing that it's really important to note is that repowering projects really need to consider planning for and engineering and construction and operations so that the development does not interfere with cleanup and does not increase threats to human health or the environment from the states. So please take a close look at the sites. Please ensure that compliance with all relevant laws and regulations are taken into account. There are many examples of state programs in a few key categories. Everything that you see here can be applied either individually or for multiple applications in one state. So everything from financial incentives and streamlined permitting to liability relief and site identification, such as mapping tools. There are lots of ways to start thinking about these concepts in your state, and we can provide you with additional information. We're just going to give you a thumbnail today, sort of a little introduction to the work that we've been doing, and we hope to connect with you more individually and dig into this information with you later on. So now we're going to sort of look at the state programs and why they matter. You can see on the map here that there's a number in each state. Those are the number of repowering projects in each state. So for example, you can see Maine has 13 projects. These projects are all renewable energy types that Repowering America's Land Initiative tracks: solar, wind, geothermal, and biomass. And this information we collect, and please let us know if you have any updated projects or policies to add to this list. Again, you can find a more in-depth list on our website. So the colors on this map correspond to policy activity. The orange color indicates states that have both financial incentives and streamlined permitting policies: Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey. The blue color indicates states that have financial incentives, and the white color is states with no repowering policies that we know of. So we're really lucky today to have panelists representing energy or environment agencies in the three states with the most repowering projects: Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey, which not coincidentally have the greatest number of projects that we know about. So in addition to looking at the number of projects, we also took a look at solar capacity on contaminated sites. And we did a little comparison that we think is very interesting. We looked at the total of solar capacity in the United States installed on contaminated sites and found that it's 2%. And we found that when you look at Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York, they come in at about 12%, 8%, and 4% of all solar capacity installed on contaminated sites. So these states have 2 to 6 times more repowering solar capacity than the US average, and they're also included in that 2%. So it is quite significant. It's not only the data, though. I want folks to understand that our stakeholders really agree. Many stakeholders say that successful programs reduce cost, time, and complexity for renewable energy projects on contaminated lands, and that they actually seek out projects in states that have these programs. So strong financial incentives are one policy that developers mention. Also, streamlined permitting is something that they mention quite a lot for encouraging development, and also liability relief. So those are three that we hear a lot from our stakeholders about. Again, we wanted to give you a little thumbnail of the steps you might take to implement a program in your state. We have much more in-depth step-by-step information, but you can see the four categories here today. We also have a sample scorecard to share with you today, which is part of the materials we've been developing. So we can review this in more in depth with you later on. And we have some tips for creating a great successful program. One is a pilot program that you might want to consider. Another is engaging with stakeholders. And we also have taken note from many of the successful states that you really need to consider the timeline for various program types. So the states with the most repowering capacity have created and implemented many program types over many years. And so if you want something that is faster to implement or that doesn't require legislation, you know, we can help you think through those aspects of creating a program. And once the programs are in place, of course, it will take time for tangible results to be seen. So, you know, renewable energy projects take quite a lot of time. So there will be, you know, time in between when you start a program in your state and when projects begin to be installed. So two documents about state programs that we have available are state program selection and design tips, and also a thumbnail description of state programs. We expect that we will be publishing this document later on, but right now these documents are available upon request, and you can email me for that information and with any other questions that we don't get to today in the program. So now I would love to hear from the state panelists. The webinar content today, all of this would not be possible without the work the states are doing. And we're really excited for our state panel. So I'm going to turn it over to Emily, who's going to talk about New York's Build Ready program today.
Great. Thank you, Laura. And thank you to all of our participants for joining our conversation today. So this slide really summarizes how our program works and some of the unique features. But before I get into the details of the program, I just wanted to provide a little bit of context for how Build Ready fits into New York State's climate and clean energy goals. So we have extremely ambitious climate change and clean energy goals in New York. We're aiming to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 85% by 2050 from 1990 levels. And as part of that, we have to have 70% of our electricity coming from renewables by 2030 and a zero emissions electricity by 2050. So the state is taking a really holistic approach to try to reach these goals, and we're investing in every aspect of the energy sector and our economy, including electricity, buildings, and transportation. And I think another thing the state is doing is that we're recognizing the importance of this energy transition being inclusive and equitable and correcting for harms done to communities in the past. And we're really integrating that into all of our laws, policies, and programs. And specifically, we're aiming to invest at least 35% of the benefits of state clean energy spending in disadvantaged communities across New York. So the Build Ready program is just really one small part of this entire strategy. And we're really trying to help achieve the goals of decarbonizing the electricity sector and bringing benefits to communities. And so the states recognize that there are these previously developed properties, contaminated sites across New York that could be repurposed for producing clean energy. But a lot of these sites are not the first choice for private renewable energy developers. They're a little bit more difficult, a little bit more complex, which requires time and cost. That's not always necessarily something that private developers can take on. But from a land use and a community development perspective, these sites are really, really important, and the state's inclined to develop these sites and see what we can do. And so this is really where our program comes in. And so the Build Ready program, we were created in 2020 through a law called the Accelerated Renewable Energy Growth and Community Benefit Act. And it established our program and requires us to identify, assess, and facilitate development of renewable energy on previously developed sites, including landfills, brownfields, and dormant electrical generating facilities, among others, and to really provide benefits to the communities where these sites are located. And then our program was further approved by an order issued by the New York Public Service Commission in late 2020. So we've been active for a little bit over a year, and we're a team of discipline experts and project managers working closely with other government agencies in New York, including EPA, Region 2 Office, the Department of Environmental Conservation, local governments and non-governmental organizations, and also the private sector. So we're a pretty unique program sitting within a state agency. We actually function very much like a private developer, but we have a few distinct differences. So in terms of similarities, we act just like a private developer. We go out and we prospect sites. So we're with a priority and a focus on underutilized, contaminated sites that have been used for other purposes and are now sitting and could potentially be used for renewable energy projects. So we go out and identify sites. We conduct initial feasibility assessment, including getting landowner interest, looking at interconnection feasibility, environmental considerations, understanding the community sentiment and support, thinking about the eventual engineering design of our project, and understanding also the liability concerns for our site, particularly for contaminated sites, and understanding the overall financial and economic feasibility of a project. So if a project continues to look good after this initial assessment, we then begin further investment into the site. And so that's really going through obtaining site control, working through the permitting processes, working through the interconnection process with the New York Independent System Operator, working with our state partners and local government partners to try to limit the liability that an eventual private developer would be taking on, and engaging with the community closely to develop a community benefits package that's going to really help the community meet some of its goals. So I'd say that's some of the similarities that we have with a private developer, but some of the main differences is that our program is really set up acknowledging that these are complex, difficult sites. They're going to take time to develop. And so our program can be a little bit more patient, I would say. And we know that we're going to have to coordinate closely with a lot of different agencies to get over some of the challenges that we face. So for example, we are working on a site right now where it's going to take us over a year, maybe more, to get official site control of that project because of some of the complexities associated with the real estate transaction. We can take that time. A private developer might not necessarily be willing to do that and might decide not to advance that site. But because underlying the site, it's a contaminated site with really great potential and community support, we're working hard with the community and the government agencies to move that site forward. And then finally, I would just say, our program is really set up to de-risk sites for eventual developers. We are not actually set up to construct and operate the site. So when a site gets to a point where we've determined through consultation with the private sector that we've de-risked it enough, we then take that site to what we call auction, which is basically where we go and sell the site or a portfolio of sites. We select a qualified private developer to transition and take over the site from us, and they'll actually finance, construct, and operate and own that project. And when we take the site to auction, we're selling the site with a financial incentive, which makes it even more attractive to the private sector. So we've de-risked the site for them, covered some of those costs, and then we're actually going to be offering developers a 20-year renewable energy credit agreement, a REC, with the project, which we can do as NYSERDA. So when we're selling the site, we get reimbursed for our costs that we've incurred to develop the site. And then we also are providing the developers with a financial incentive to support the project through the REC agreement. So since our project's just a little bit over a year old, we haven't taken a site to auction yet, but we plan to later this year. And so that's just a little bit about the Build Ready program and what we're doing. There's other programs across the state that are supporting reuse of sites, which I will talk about a little bit later. But I'll end there with my opening remarks. Thanks.
Super. Wow, Emily, that was such a great start. New York has this really unique program, and it's really great to see how you're identifying and screening these sites for redevelopment. So next we'll hear from Gina, who is working on a similar effort, however, quite distinct in Massachusetts. Go ahead, Gina.
Thanks, Laura. And can advance the slide, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here and happy to be representing Massachusetts today. Sitting alongside some great states and a great overview by Emily. It's really insightful to hear what New York is working on. What I'll be discussing is a little bit high level on just some of the Massachusetts programs. Laura previously mentioned ours is incentive based and started out pretty much with a deep penetration from our SREC program. We incentivize solar with a higher SREC factor and got a lot of interest in solar in the state of Massachusetts. So it really brought in a lot of developers here who are interested in solar and have kind of stuck around and working in the state. So moving into our SMART program, we continue to see projects coming in on landfills and brownfields, slightly less just because, you know, the rate is decreasing because so many of those sites were picked up through the SREC program. So we still work with Department of Energy Protection to confirm that these sites are good for solar and so forth within our SMART program right now. The SMART program is the program that I'm currently overseeing in making sure that we're processing these projects appropriately. So really the SMART program is coming out of the Massachusetts Solar Act, trying to get ratepayers, you know, getting solar through at a cheaper rate for ratepayers. So we continue to do that and still are able to incentivize these projects with, as Laura mentioned earlier, kilowatt hour adders and incentives. So 3 or 4 cents respectively for each of those landfill or brownfields. So we look into those. And yeah, I think I may keep it brief there. I think I can show the numbers here and can say that really we were able to get so many projects in Massachusetts by engaging with stakeholders early on. That was important for us. I think in a state with such a dense population and so many different interests, we really had to work with local communities and statewide to make sure everyone's interests were being shown. So I think I'll leave it there and pass back to Laura.
Okay, great. Thanks, Gina. Your numbers really speak for themselves. So just a reminder really quickly, if you have any questions as we're going along, please go ahead and put those in the Q&A and also vote on any questions that you see that you like. So we'll also be hearing from Steve Myers today from New Jersey. So Steve, go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here representing New Jersey and speaking with all the attendees. I'm looking forward to hearing some of the questions. They have already seen some good ones in the chat. So New Jersey has been working on repowering initiative incentives since 2012, the last 10 years. Subsection T of the Solar Act of 2012 essentially incentivized projects on brownfields, properly closed sanitary landfills, and areas of historic fill. Subsequently, the Clean Energy Act of 2018 incentivized the same projects with a different incentive, and it also established a community solar energy pilot program that provided enhanced scoring, if you will, for brownfields, landfills, and areas of historic fill. Currently, Solar Act of 2021 was passed in July of last year. That mandates 3.75 gigawatts of new solar by 2026. Currently, New Jersey has 3.76 gigawatts of installed solar capacity. While New Jersey is ranked number 7 in installed solar capacity based on the size of our state, we're actually ranked number 1 in capacity per square mile. So that's something we're very proud of. The Solar Act of 2021 essentially develops two programs, the administratively determined incentive program for net meter projects less than 5 megawatts and community solar projects, as well as subsection T site types. I should just refer to them as repowering sites, since that's the link that we're using here today. And BPU is going to be developing the permit community solar program here in short order. The other portion of the Solar Act of 2021 is the Competitive Solicitation Incentive Program, and that's going to target net meter projects over 5 megawatts and grid supply projects. The first stakeholder meeting was held in November of last year, and we anticipate additional stakeholder meetings coming in the near term. And there's going to be specific bidding categories, as well as certain site restrictions. And all that information can be found at the URL at the bottom of the page. And I have one more slide to go through that's going to talk about New Jersey's repowering resources. So in 2012, New Jersey developed a solar siting analysis. It's a statewide analysis based on our land use land cover from 2007. We essentially assigned a preferred, not preferred, indeterminate value to the Anderson codes that are developed by the U.S. Geological Survey. And based on that analysis, we updated it in 2017 to bring in and leverage geospatial analyses. And we identified at that time that essentially 29% of the state is preferred. So that number was a little surprising to some. But New Jersey is a very diverse state with a lot of natural resources. My background is from High Point State Park, just for reference. We developed a community solar siting tool to support the program that BPU has developed via the pilot program. And again, as I said, the permanent program is going to be developed in short order here. And this tool has hosting capacity data, which is very valuable, obviously. If you're looking to develop a site, regardless of what site it is, has electric distribution company, service territories, landfills, air source field, non-contaminated sites. We essentially modeled this application after the evaluation criteria in BPU's community solar pilot program. Additionally, DEP has a streamlined permitting process. You can come into our Office of Permitting and Project Navigation. You basically fill out a checklist and you submit that to them, identifying where your site is and all the different attributes of it and what you may know about it. And they will schedule a meeting with all of our program area experts and give you feedback. We stress that you come and talk to us before you submit any applications for any incentives. We'd rather give you the good news and the bad news, if any, up front, as opposed to finding that out later in the process. And I'll leave it at that. And there's some two additional URLs at the bottom of the page there for folks to go check out this additional information and resources. So I'll pass it back to you, Laura.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Steve. That was really great. So just a reminder to everyone in the audience that these slides are available on the website for the CLUIN registration. So now we're going to go to our panel discussion. We have our first question, which is about program linkages in your states. So how does the program that you highlighted complement other programs or policies? And how do you specifically work with other agencies and local governments in your state on repowering type site development? I think we'll go to Emily. And Gina and Steve.
Sure. Sure. So first, just with even in NYSERDA, our program complements another existing program that we offer. So within NYSERDA, in our NY Sun program, there are incentives under the megawatt block, which are offered for distributed generation solar projects. And so those incentives include an adder, similar to the SMART program that Massachusetts, that Gina was talking about, for projects that are going to be sited on landfills and brownfields. So there's additional incentive for projects that fit within the distributed generation side. And then our program is really focused on larger scale projects. So projects that wouldn't necessarily be eligible for the NY Sun landfill brownfill adder and overall incentive that's available. So that's one way that we're kind of complementing just within the authority itself and for the state with the incentives that we can offer. So with our program, as I said, we offer a renewable energy credit agreement, which is what New York State uses for larger scale projects. So most of our projects that we're aiming for are 10 megawatts or larger right now. And so that's one way we complement. And then another way is we do work very closely with the Department of Environmental Conservation, a few different programs across the department who work on different types of contaminated sites. And so Superfund, brownfields, and then also on reclaimed mines. And then we work closely with the EPA too, with the Region 2 office. And so when the program was first initially launched, we actually had a meeting with programs and departments from across the state where they actually identified sites that they thought could be good candidates for our program. And that was kind of where our initial screening efforts were around. And so we've continued working with those agencies. And as we, as sites kind of are prioritized that have been identified or that we've identified through other means, one of the first things we do is we go and speak to our state partners, our federal partners about the sites to make sure we're kind of understanding the situation. And then once we're working on a site specifically, we're engaging with the local government throughout the entire process. So it's within a town, that's the town government, the county, and then also we also work closely with the industrial development agencies within the county. So a lot of coordination with other programs and trying to kind of support what's already been undertaken across the state.
Okay, Gina.
Thanks, and thanks, Emily. So for Massachusetts, kind of what I had maybe addressed a little bit earlier was these types of projects really complement our decarbonization roadmap to have net zero emissions by 2050. And I think that that really takes into account the, you know, Massachusetts landscape as a whole and what areas we're using to power it. And within the DOERs, within the Department of Energy and Environmental Affairs or Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs. And we really look at the land holistically and I think want to prioritize these types of projects. So we are undergoing a solar technical potential study to figure out exactly, you know, we've had less come in under the landfills and brownfields, we are still going to reassess and determine where more of these can come in. So really within our secretariat, we're working to continue growing these projects.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, a lot of collaboration among the different energy and environment departments. And Steve?
Hi, yeah. DEP basically works directly with the Board of Public Utilities on a regular basis with respect to subsection T and development of siting tools and policy. Essentially, when a subsection T application is submitted to the Board of Public Utilities, they refer it to the DEP for the technical review to determine if we believe the site is a brownfield, a properly closed sanitary landfill, and or an area of historic fill. So we work with them on a regular basis. With respect to local communities, we have a community collaborative initiative that DEP and the Economic Development Authority have developed to work with 12 urban communities to support their addressing their environmental challenges. And we're providing them with solar studying support, as well as advising them on community energy planning and energy efficiency opportunities that are available through the Board of Public Utilities. Turn it back
okay,
to you.
Great. Super. Thank you guys so much. So the next question is, some programs in the states have been around for a long time. What are some lessons learned from within your state from developing and administering the programs?
I'm happy to jump in there. Just because our RPS solar carve-out program, SREC program, really brought a lot of projects in. And I think that that was due in part to working with stakeholders early on. I think we learned a lot from getting stakeholder feedback. We, you know, as other agencies do, post for public comment and get feedback from the private and public sector as well. So I think that's been really helpful for us.
All right, Emily.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk a little bit about some of the lessons we've learned so far, acknowledging that our program's been around for a little bit over a year. So we're definitely still learning a lot. But I think one of the biggest lessons so far is that, you know, this work really does take time, and that might be obvious to a lot of people in this webinar. But developing renewable energy projects on just a traditional greenfield site is a very time-intensive process, and on a contaminated site or another type of underutilized site, it's even more time-consuming. So there's difficulties and complexities that we are coming across, and it really takes long-term commitment and investment to identify and resolve the challenges associated with these sites. And I think for every site, you're going to hit some sort of snag, and so it's just a matter of when you're going to hit that snag. And so I think, and you might be able to resolve those issues, or you might not be able to. And so a project is going to fall out. And so I think because it takes time, because these are difficult sites, because our job as Build Ready is to advance sites to eventual auction to the private sector, it's really important for us to have a strong pipeline of projects. So we're just continually progressing sites, because we know that, hey, we could have five sites that look great today, but tomorrow, all five of the sites might no longer be viable for us because of one reason or another. And I think as part of the process, we've really learned also a lot about how important the interconnection process is, and that tends to really be a major linchpin, I would say, for a lot of projects. A lot of the environmental remediation work, the community engagement work, that stuff all takes time, and there's liability issues we have to figure out, and it's, you know, working with the communities to figure out how we can best have these projects meet their needs. But with some of the interconnection challenges, that sometimes they're just things you can't get past. And so I think overall, just kind of connecting with everything I just said, like, it takes time and commitment. And so if your agency is going to take on a program like Build Ready, I think making sure that people are committed to the program and that resources have been allocated. And I do think it's a really excellent way of using public sector resources and partnering with the private sector. Like, I do think this is a great way for the public sector to step in, take on more risk, de-risk these sites, and then for the private sector to come in and do their job of actually, developing, constructing them and operating them. So I think it's a nice way of bringing together the comparative advantages of both the public and private sector. So I'll stop there.
That's a really good point. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Steve. So with respect to mapping applications, we've been developing mapping applications since 2010 to support repowering projects. DEP has been leveraging GIS for 35 years. We're actually SREC customer number 53. We start out in 2010, basically, you know, with trying to inventory and identify and map our repowering resources with landfills, known contaminated sites, and areas of historic fill, and basically the utility service territories. And now we've got our mapping tools that have, you know, 30 to 40 different layers. You know, we're also now mapping the existing projects once they're installed, right? So then you have a sense of that kind of leads towards lead by example, identify where projects are, and then, you know, their success stories. But again, some of the challenges aren't right. Is now that we have so much data, it becomes a little bit of a maintenance challenge. So we're always encouraging, you know, the data stewards and the owners to, you know, update their data on a quarterly basis, I'll say. You know, resources are limited. So if you can get the data stewards and the owners to, you know, publish map services and whatnot, so you can just grab the data and pull it into your applications, that's a real efficient way. And over the last, you know, number of years, more data is becoming readily available out there that wasn't years ago. The Energy Information Administration has substation data, electrical substation data, GIS-wise, that folks might find interest in pulling that into their applications, depending on how, you know, what the solar interconnection rules are in your state and whatnot. So anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, great. And then the other question we have is, what advice do you have for other states and localities considering these types of programs? Emily, do you want to start on that?
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of the insights that you distilled earlier, Laura, in your slides are really spot on. So I would say it's really important to try to identify the goal of the program that you're the goal that your program is trying to achieve and understand what programs already exist in your state so that your program can support those programs and then fill the gaps that those programs maybe aren't currently covering when it comes to encouraging renewable energy siting on contaminated lands or other types of underutilized lands. And then I would also say then when it comes to setting up a program, especially one similar to Build Ready, it's going to take, once the agency kind of gets the approval to do so, it's going to take time and resources to get the program up and running. And I think one of the things that we have been working through is that for us to undertake some of the activities that are required for renewable energy development, such as site acquisition, such as we're actually forming special purpose holding companies or LLCs for our projects, which will then make the eventual transfer to private developers much cleaner. Those were things that the authority wasn't necessarily authorized to do under our existing rules and regulations. So identifying what those things are and then figuring out the process to kind of get those, to get the authority to do that was definitely something that took some time, but was interesting to do. So I think just, it's not only the kind of the time it will take agency to kind of design and its program and launch it, but then the things that you actually have to then do to begin implementing the program itself is something to be aware of. And so I think just having like a really strong team that brings different skills and then strong both internal and external legal counsel kind of supporting you throughout the whole process.
Super. Gina or Steve, do you want to address advice for other states or locals?
I think Emily said a lot of really helpful tips there, and I would reiterate working with stakeholders and other agencies early on and determining what sort of incentives work, and additionally using mapping tools and doing solar studies to determine where this land is. Helpful.
I concur with that. I would say also, you know, try and find people with GIS experience and certificates when you're hiring. That's something that definitely jumps off the resume when we're looking to hire staff. it's become such a valuable resource, right? Unless you know if you don't know the assets in your state and where they are, and all the intricacies, it's tough to develop policy. You know, initially we develop our tools to support locational information and whatnot. And then over time we realized, hey, this is great information to inform policy, not just locate sites for renewable energy.
That's really great advice. Yeah, a lot of it comes down to the site specifics and the details. So, well, we have some great questions in the Q&A from the participants. There is one that has risen to the top by far, and I'm going to take that one so we can get that right out of the way. Will you touch upon funding opportunities for these types of activities? And I'm going to say thank you very much for the question and all of the upvoting on that. We do here at Repowering America's Land Initiative have a lot of assistance that we can provide in terms of helping you identify funding for your programs and your sites. So this gets down to a very site-specific level, depending on what type of site it is. If you have a Superfund site, there are certain funding opportunities. If you have a brownfields site, there are certain types of opportunities and so forth. So it is really important to understand all of the intricacies of how those funding programs work, and we can help provide you with information that can help you do that. So my strong suggestion is that if you do want to find out more, that you reach out to me or someone on the Repowering America's Land Initiative team. Again, you can find our contact information on our website, and we will be happy to help you with those kinds of opportunities. So we have a question about specifically problem with the chat. The Q&A as they move. So let's see. I'm going to see if there's, okay, so here's a question for the panel. Are any of you aware of instances where solar has negatively impacted the landfill or brownfield integrity? Here at Repowering America's Land Initiative, we get this question quite a bit, and we do not know of any, but wondering if anyone on the panel knows of any.
I would say, you know, initially, sometimes when you install a solar array, right, there's going to be some settling that happens. Project developers need to, you know, maintain the cap of the landfill, you know, in accordance with our rules and regulations, obviously. But yeah, to the inquirer's point, there's a challenge when the solar developer isn't necessarily the property owner, right? And the property owner is the one that's ultimately the responsible entity for keeping the site under regulatory control. So there can definitely be issues, but at the same time, they need to be addressed through compliance and enforcement at times if need be, but hopefully it doesn't come to that.
Okay. Yeah, I guess just to add to that, I don't know of any examples where the cap's been penetrated or led to any issues. As Stephen was saying, depending on the type of landfill, the type of waste that is contained in that landfill will kind of determine also how long you want to wait until you start developing on a site like that. Because you usually want to wait for a certain amount of years until some of the settlement has already taken place before developing a project. And there's ways to then construct the project so that you're not actually penetrating the cap. The system lies on top. So there's the developers who do this, who have the expertise in how to develop and construct properly and operate projects on landfills and brownfields, have methods of doing it to really, really limit the risk of that happening.
Great, okay, thanks. So we have a lot of questions about streamlining. and streamlining various processes. So can any of you speak to the typical permitting and related activities that your states undergo for streamlining all of the various permits? I know that there are several states that have sort of collaborative efforts among the different agencies. Does anybody want to take that question?
I could talk about New York. So for permitting of renewable energy projects, we basically have two lien processes, which are kind of guide, and depending which process you go into, it's based on the size of the project that you're developing. So projects below 25 megawatts go under the local permitting process. And so they have to follow the State Environmental Quality and Review Act process. And so it's usually the local government, or it can be another agency that's going to be working as the authority that will be working through the permitting with the developer. For projects that are above 25 megawatts, we have a new streamlined permitting process. Actually, the same law that established the Build Ready program, the Accelerated Renewable Energy Growth and Benefit Act, also established a new Office of Renewable Energy Siting in New York. And so that office has developed new regulations for the permitting of renewable energy projects that are 25 megawatts or greater, which is meant to streamline and speed up the process. And projects that are between 20 and 25 megawatts can actually opt into that process if they want to, rather than going through the local process, but they don't have to. So there's basically two different permitting processes for renewable energy projects in New York, dependent on the size of the project. And then from the environmental perspective, for the contaminated sites, you obviously have to be working closely with the DEC on those projects and ensuring that you're complying with and maintaining the requirements that have already been put in place for that site in particular.
Also, as I mentioned earlier, DEP in New Jersey has a Office of Permitting and Project Navigation with staff that are specifically assigned to be working on renewable energy projects. You fill out the checklist, you submit it, you come in for a meeting, and you'll have representatives from our land use program or stormwater permitting program. The sites in the Highlands or the Pylons, those staff will be invited. Staff from the Board of Public Utilities will be invited. It's basically a one-stop shop for all things renewable energy permitting.
And I would add, I think Massachusetts is maybe similar to New Jersey and what Stephen was saying, in that we look to the developers to provide us with the appropriate documentation on the capped landfills and so forth. And we check with DEP here to make sure everything is squared away. That's about it.
Great. Thank you. There is a question about coordinating with the ISO. And I am curious about whether or not the system operators, whether you know if there's any coordination with them on any interconnection issues. The question that has come in is specific to New Jersey and PJM.
Could you read back the question?
Sure. The specific question is New Jersey working with PJM to streamline the interconnection process for projects on brownfields and reclaimed mines?
Yeah, New Jersey, the Board of Public Utilities is currently hosting a grid modernization stakeholding process. So we're actually right in the middle of that right now. Depending on what type of solar project you're looking to develop, if it's a grid supply project, you're going to PJM directly. I believe if you're doing a net metered project and or community solar project under the pilot program, you're going directly to the utility in the state of New Jersey. So it kind of all depends on which type of project you're looking to develop. But good question. I would advise you to go to the Board of Public Utilities website to dial into the grid modernization stakeholdering process and meeting schedule.
Thank you. That's really great. Thank you. Interconnection is so important on these projects. And Emily, there are a few questions about New York and where the funding comes from. Do you want to address some of those?
Yeah, sure. So in the order that approved the Build Ready program, our budget was set out and approved. And we're initially funded through the Clean Energy Fund. And in our order, in our budget, it also specifically says that this is initial funding to basically capitalize the program. And we are then meant to pay back the fund for this startup capital. And the way that we do that is, as I was saying before, we go out and we cover the direct costs of advancing these sites. And then we go out and sell them to the private sector. So when we're selling them, we are going to be recovering the costs that we've spent on developing those sites. And then we'll be offering the renewable energy credit agreement. So we will have to repay basically the funds that have been set up to fund our program through the selling and auctioning of the sites. And so that's kind of how our funding is structured right now. And I think there was also a question about how will people know when we're going to be selling a site or auctioning a site? And so we'll plan on making it very well known to the sector that we have a site coming to auction. And they'll have a way to participate when an auction starts taking place. And there will likely be prerequisites for developers to participate in our auctions. And we're working on that process right now. And we're actually going to be issuing a request for information later this year on our general auction process to get feedback from stakeholders.
Thanks, Emily. And you guys also have a listserv distribution list, right, that folks can sign up for?
Yes. Yeah, we do. So that will be one way that we will be notifying people, among others.
Okay, super. Thank you so much. All right. So there's one question that's at the top of the queue, which is navigating liability and bonding issues. And this is specific to mine sites and Wyoming. And I'll start and then just see if our panelists have anything else to add. So these issues can be very specific and, challenging issues. So it's really important to understand the liability laws and the framework surrounding the site that you're interested in. My suggestion would be that an initial point of contact could be the EPA regional contact in Region H. That person's name is on our website. And if you can't find it, you can always email me and I can get you that information. So that's a great place to start. And also, I believe that there are, experts in each state that can help you with any state program liability issues. Does anybody else on the panel have anything to add on liability or bonding?
I would just say it's something that we're coming across with our projects. There are liability issues associated with the sites. And so one of the things we're trying to do is figure out how we can manage those issues and provide certainty to the eventual developers that they're not going to necessarily be held responsible for everything that might take place. So we've been working closely with the DEC and the EPA Region 2 office. And so, for example, for a site that we're working on right now on an abandoned paper mill, we've worked with EPA Region 2 to get a comfort letter associated with that site. And then also we're working with the DC on getting a covenant not to sue put in place. So I think it's going to be very site by site specific, like what the specific liability challenges are going to be. And so working closely with legal counsel, and then I think the environmental agencies in your state is really important. And they've been great thus far to work with on trying to resolve these issues and get some of these agreements and mechanisms in place to reduce liability concerns.
It sounds like New Jersey is similar to New York in that fashion. And that's something that our site remediation and waste management program is more involved with. So I would direct folks to contact them.
Thanks. Okay, so we have a question about typically developers don't look to landfills or brownfields necessarily for a first cut at the sites that they're looking for to develop renewable energy. And so, you know, a lot of our discussion today has been around the successful state programs that you all are a part of. What needs to change to have developers kind of look at these sites as first go sites? I mean, is it the case in your states that developers do take a better look at sites, brownfields and other related contaminated lands in your states because of the programs that you have, do you think? Gina, do you wanna start on that question?
Sure. Yeah, I think really incentives have helped in our state. I think it's a little bit different in New York in that their program is functioning a little bit differently and where the risk lies and so forth. But I think at least for Massachusetts, making those incentives higher has really drawn a lot of developers into the state and stayed here for that reason.
I would just add from New Jersey's perspective, I would just say to follow our the competitive solicitation incentives, the CSI stakeholdering process is forthcoming, and that's happening now. In that, you know, we're having I think the law basically the Solar Act of 2021 has a broader definition. So, you know, whereas we may not have had as many brownfield development solar projects as we would have liked historically. I think the new law is going to provide a little bit more leeway with respect to brownfields as well as landfills. Some of that adjacent land around the landfill may not be on the cap, maybe off the cap, but it's still land that's, you know, not being used for anything else, frankly. So we're looking forward to leveraging additional space at some of these site types that historically we were, you know, legally restricted from doing. So we're anticipating that being, an avenue for future and additional success beyond what we've already achieved.
And I guess just to add on to what everyone else has said, I think the NYSUN megawatt block incentive, and particularly the landfill and brownfields adder, I think has helped drive investment by solar developers into projects on landfills and brownfields. There are renewable energy developers in New York State who focus exclusively on landfills and brownfields. They see that as a niche business opportunity. And I think the additional incentive that the state offers is helpful for continuing to make that attractive for them. I think our program was set up because for us to reach our renewable energy goals, it's going to take renewable energy projects of all different scales. And when it comes to larger utility scale projects, I think that's where you've seen less interest in the private sector to go after contaminated brownfield landfill underutilized sites. And so the kind of decision was made to let's have this be state led for the time being and see what we're able to achieve working in partnership with the private sector, kind of taking this public-private partnership model.
Okay, that's really great. Thank you. Thanks for that excellent question. And we have this really great question here about engaging with local permitting authorities. So zoning and siting and all of that. I know that many of your states have really robust programs to reach out to local entities. Would you like to talk about the work that you do to encourage and collaborate with the local governments in your states?
This is Steve. I would just mention again our community collaborative initiative amongst 12 overburdened communities in New Jersey, as a model for other states to leverage. We basically have staff at DP that are, you know, boots on the ground, essentially working with these communities to educate them on all the various renewable energy and energy efficiency programs that are available to them.
And I think just to speak to a little bit about New York. So at NYSERDA, there's various programs that work on clean energy siting. We actually have a dedicated team that works directly with local governments on helping them with clean energy siting of renewable energy projects, whether that's reviewing their local zoning laws or answering questions specifically related to a project that might be going through their local processes. So there's training and capacity building that local governments can access through other NYSERDA programs. We also have a program called the Clean Energy Communities, which also provides support to local governments across the state. And they actually have coordinators that sit in different regions of our state who can really help work with their particular region and local governments in their regions, and then connect them to other resources across the authority or with other programs or other agencies. And our program, you know, depending on the size of our project, we will be going through the local permitting process that local governments have put in place. And there are streamlined permitting processes that are recommended for local governments in New York. We have a unified solar permit that can be adopted. That's going to be for, I think, projects that are 25 kW or less. So it's meant for smaller projects, but there are, if you're interested in learning at least what New York has done, you know, permitting is very state specific, but if you're interested in learning more about what New York State has done, there are a lot of resources on NYSERDA's website about options for streamlining permitting processes.
I'll just add one more thing is with respect to like our statewide solar slang analysis. I mean, obviously every municipality is different, right? You have some municipalities that are primarily forested, some that are primarily ag land, some that are primarily urban. So it creates unique challenges for every municipality. So just want to point that out.
I would also add that in the Department of Energy Resources and other divisions outside of mine, we do have divisions such as our Green Communities team and Leading by Example team who work with municipalities specifically to help them on projects and not necessarily with permitting, but maybe in trying to get a grant for something specific in their municipality.
That's really great. Okay, thank you so much for that. I think we're gonna have one last question. There are a couple questions specific to New Jersey. Steve. So there's one on how do you keep up with all the mapping changes, like the technology changes? And then there's another one on what's the first step a New Jersey municipality should take when considering putting solar on a brownfield?
So we have an entire Bureau of GIS and DEP, and we also have an Office of GIS under our Department of Treasury. So there are a lot of people behind the scenes in helping us develop our data and create our data and publish our data, as well as giving us great training sessions on all things GIS. So it is no small undertaking. Like I said, the one good thing is that when we're successful in getting the data stewards and owners to publish their data in a web service, it's great for everybody. And if you go and look at our community solar siting tool, which can be used for, you know, solar siting on many a project in New Jersey, it's not just specific to community solar. That data can be copied, you know, and pulled into other, your own, you know, online applications or desktop applications. So, but yeah, as I had mentioned earlier in the talk is, you know, keeping up with the maintenance side of things is definitely challenging, but we have a great staff and we're able to do it. So we're fortunate that way. And with respect to the municipality question in brownfields, I would say, again, use our community solar studying tool, go to your municipality, look at where your landfills and brownfields and known contaminated sites and air historic fill are on your D notices. Look at the hosting capacity that may be in proximity to those locations, and basically do an inventory and prioritize what you think is best for your community, and then figure out a way to make it happen. And we are always here to meet with you and talk with you. And BPU has a community energy planning program, and their staff are willing to meet with you. So we're very accessible.
That's great. Well, with that, I think we are almost out of time. We have some really great questions today. Thank you so much to the audience for all of your questions. And thank you so much for the panelists who joined us today and took a lot of time to prepare and to participate today. We just can't thank you enough, Gina and Steve and Emily, our great partners in the states of New York, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. With that, I'm going to turn it back to our host, Jean Ballant. And thank you so much for everybody, your participation today.
All right. Thank you so very much, Laura. And again, I echo your thanks to our panelists. I'm going to call just a few things here up on the screen and walk through a few final reminders for our audience in our session today. So the first thing I want to do is just remind everybody, as you've noted, the presentation materials are currently available for them to download from the seminar homepage. If you weren't here at the very beginning of today's webinar, I highlighted this URL. It's the same URL you received in your reminder and confirmation emails when registering. So on that seminar homepage, it's highlighted in yellow here. You can take a screenshot of this if you like. You can visit it. And on that page, there are a series of tabs, and one of the tabs will have a direct link to the webinar materials and related links. So that seminar homepage is available from today forward. You can bookmark it and reference it anytime that you like. You'll also find information about our speakers there and a link to our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of our session today. I know that some of you may have to hop off and run, so I'm going to pop off one more set of questions up before we close things out today. But I do want to address one of the most common questions that I get as a technical moderator before I put those questions on the screen. Oftentimes, our attendees will ask if we offer CEUs or PDHs in our events. While we don't issue those types of credit hours, I can provide you with a participation certificate like the one shown on this slide if you fill out our online feedback form. So if you follow the link to the online feedback form, it'll pop up after we end today's webinar as well. As I noted, it's on the seminar homepage. If you fill out that form and make sure that you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire session and then submit your feedback, you'll then immediately have access to one of these certificates. If you happen to host a viewing party in your location and others joined you at that spot without actually registering on their own, all you simply need to do is share the link to the feedback form with them. They can fill it out on their own and get their own participation certificate, even though they didn't register individually. And for those of you who are replaying the recorded version of today's webinar in our online archive, somewhere above my head in the upper right, you should see a button now that will point you to that same seminar feedback form. You can still fill that form out based off of your replay of today's archive. Again, making sure you check that box at the bottom and get a certificate based off of rewatching our recorded session. So with that, I'm going to pop open one last set of questions that we have for you, just asking a little bit about our webinar. So I'm going to launch that poll right now. If you could share your thoughts with us and let us know if the webinar met your expectations and any topics that you would like to hear about on future sessions, and then submit. You guys are then welcome to use the button in the lower left then end, or pardon me, to leave the webinar. So I'll leave that poll open here for a few more seconds. Again, I want to thank everybody who joined us on our broadcast today. We had a great turnout. Over 300 people joined us for the live session. I also want to thank our support staff on in the background who helped to make it happen. And again, all of the organizers and panelists who have shared their expertise on our session today. So I think we're getting close to time to close things out for the day. I'm going to leave that poll up there here for just a few more seconds before we close things up. I'll put on some delightful hold music as we get ready to close things out today.